Hi, and welcome to the How Not to Think podcast. I'm Dr. Howard Rankin, and today I'm delighted to have with me all the way from Chicago, via Roma, or at least Italia, Joy Laverde, who is an expert in elder care. She's got two great books out about elder care, on the preparation for elder care, the things that you need to do. And we're going to get talking about that. It's just a huge topic. And so, Joy, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Howard.
Great. First question I always ask is, how did you get into this space and where you are now?
I was a high school volunteer. I went to an all-girls Catholic high school, and Sister Dorothy marched into the homeroom. I was a freshman, and she said, "Who is going to the nursing home with me on Thanksgiving morning?" And I raised my hand as a volunteer because I knew that that would help me with my schoolwork and the nuns getting to know me and so on. But there we were, me and Sister Dorothy, going into the nursing home, Thanksgiving morning, and seven people are sitting in the dark. And I could not wrap my head around this scene. I remember it as though it were yesterday. And I said to myself, something's terribly wrong. And that began my journey. It wasn't until my later years that I began to see that writing a book about communicating with each other would begin the process of someone never ending their life alone. And that's how I got into it.
Oh, that's a great, great, great story, and inspirational. Yes, and there's so many aspects of senior care that I think, you know, lend themselves well to the sort of inspection that we do on this podcast, looking at myths, stereotypes, sort of binary thinking and things that really don't help. I am somewhat familiar with the field. I did help someone in the industry write a book on the future of senior care, which was really eye-opening to me. And personally, my mother-in-law, who lived to be almost 98, went through this process and was in, you know, assisted living. And, you know, I saw firsthand how even in an upscale facility, some of the things that don't work as well as they should. I mentioned your book. You've got one book on sort of planning for elder care, right? Which takes people through the questions they have to ask. Is that right?
The first book is specifically targeted for the caregiver. And that could be caregiver of a spouse, a parent, a grandparent, even a friend. Right. And the second book is all about us. So that's called Who Will Take Care of Me When I'm Old?
Yes. Yes.
So and two different focuses. And most people don't realize that the caregiving pretty much never ends. So we're going to be doing both simultaneously. We take care of somebody, and then we got to do this for ourselves. And that will really impact the decisions we make as we go through this process.
Right. And there are many tough decisions or seemingly tough decisions that need to be made that get, in my experience, this was not the case with my mother-in-law, but I've seen it in other families. A lot of different views about how somebody should be taken care of and different levels of involvement and, you know, all different motives. It just gets so complicated.
Yeah. Well, typically that's a lack of planning. If we say what we want, if we put it in writing, if we make it legal, then there's not too much to, and then we have conversations. That's the most important thing. I have the utmost faith in the medical field. They do their job and they do it very well. It's everything else that falls apart. Mm-hmm. It's not the doctors and the nurses. When we argue with the medical field, it's because we're out of control. It's mm-hmm. like typically we haven't made a plan for what happens when this is the case. So yes, lack of planning is the culprit of everything.
Mm, yes. And I can at least identify several, but from your perspective, what are the myths and misconceptions that people have that really need to be addressed if you're going to organize effective care for yourself or even somebody else?
The assumption that we get sick. That is a total myth. It is not necessarily true. My mother died at 92, quite healthy. She mm-hmm. just didn't wake up one day, mm-hmm. just died in her sleep. And there is a misconception that the kind of conversations we need to have with the elders in our lives has everything to do with care. And most of the time, it has to do with just quality of life. How do you want to get to church? How do you want to get to the hairdresser? What can we do to plan dinner together? These are things about relationships. But people automatically jump from, okay, I'm looking over there and now I have to talk about care. They forget the relationship. So the misconception is that people get sick when they get old is what's driving many inappropriate conversations between people.
Yeah, that's really an excellent point that how that, you know, the framing effect, how that conversation is framed. And how it's anchored. Oh, we're talking about your health. No, we're talking about your life, right? We're not talking about your health, exactly. We're talking about your life. Health is part of it, but it's not the only part of it. And that's really an excellent, excellent point. And people's perspectives, not necessarily, as you say, their health, their perspectives change as they get older, right? I think that's my experience. Anyway,
yeah, the way that I look at it is we may have not needed something at one point in our life, and now we need something else, and it's the transition of trying to negotiate that limbo space. That's where people get stuck. So we need to all spend more time in limbo looking at things so that we can get to the other side and say, oh, okay, the way I used to think no longer applies now. And also know that this is quite normal. Like nothing's wrong with us. It's just that this is the way things are. So yes, we are changing. We are evolving. And that process alone scares people to death. They just get scared. They get stumped. And they think, well, maybe we shouldn't be doing this. But if they only realize, yes, living in limbo has many, many, it's the most creative time in our life.
Yes.
To create what we can create while we don't know the answers to anything.
Right. And and part of that is that intersection of sort of wisdom and consciousness and recognizing what you don't know and being okay with that. And this was brought home to me. I mentioned my mother-in-law, and, you know, we live on the South Carolina coast. And when hurricanes came our way or threatened, they evacuated to, you know, inland. And my wife and I would go and find a place right nearby where they evacuated so we could, you know, be with my mother-in-law and, you know, if she needed convincing what was going on or needed reassurance, we were there. And, you know, there were probably 80 or 90 people in this hotel waiting this out. Wow. And hurricane was coming and... They had a pastor coming in to give a service, and he was going on about how in these difficult times and, you know, what have you. Actually, what was really interesting, these people were probably the calmest people in the state. They were. It was I mean, unless they had, you know, family that was in the way of a hurricane they were concerned about, apart from that, I was, been through it before, no big deal. Let's sit around, play cards, play games, whatever, it's okay. Everyone else is freaking out.
Yeah. Oh, I love this conversation. And this just drives home the point of why I tell younger people, you must have people who are at least 30 years older than you in your life. Mm. They calm you down. They've been through everything. They know so much. And that you think your life is falling apart, just spend time with someone who is just, okay, well, tell me about it. And then there's just such calm and peacefulness.
It was fabulous. It was a tremendous insight. Mm-hmm. It was wonderful to watch, but it was also a great insight. You know, as I said, literally everyone else was freaking out, and they were probably the calmest, cooler people around. Like, okay, well, when are we going to have supper? Or when can we play cards? Or when's that movie coming on?
Exactly. Oh, yeah. I'm so glad you brought, I'm glad you had that experience. Mm. Yeah. It's a beautiful one.
Yeah. And I think that it's a good story in the sense that it challenges people's expectations and views of people who are older, especially in that situation. And most people would think, oh, these poor people, I bet they're freaking out. And they're, no, yeah, not really. Much less than you were. Yeah, it's really interesting, and it really goes along with your very important concept that when you look at this and you just look through the lens of illness and care, you're missing
everything. Everything. Just just yesterday I was at a social gathering because people who know what I do for a living start talking about their parents, and she was she just immediately started crying. She needed an outlet. She knew I was a safe place and so fine. And I, of course, am a compassionate listener. And so when she was finished, I said to her, I said, how often do you and your mom laugh together? And she looked at me and she said, what do you mean? And I said, have you established a fun, like, do you have fun together? And she said, well, there's so many problems. I have to do this and I have to do that. And I said, who said you have to do all that? And she immediately, you could see in her face, she just felt released. And that was all she needed. And she couldn't thank me enough. And all I did was give her permission to be the daughter that her mother loves.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, no, and, absolutely. Absolutely.
And then the tears that followed after that were the kind where she realized what a beautiful place she was in.
Yeah. When my mother-in-law was in the assisted living home, particularly the last the whole time she was there, the last 4 or 5 years of her life, either my wife or I would go visit her. It was just down the, 10 minutes away. Every afternoon, we would go visit her before dinner. And we would just have fun. We found the music from her day, and we play it and have her singing along. And I would be, she couldn't get up and down, so we made, but, I would be dancing along. And, this woman who, when you got there, was sitting there kind of staring into space. When you start playing, she came to life. She's singing, she's tapping her feet, she's smiling. Mm-hmm. That's got nothing to do with healthcare.
No, probably gave her some new, what is the chemistry that happens to us when we're happy?
Endorphins,
right?
More endorphins, yeah.
More endorphins, it's like exercise, absolutely. Oh, so yeah, so people are really, like you said, missing the relationships of these enormously important people in our lives. Also, it opens up the opportunity for us to talk, to let them trust that they can talk about what it's like to be closer in age to death than mm-hmm. perhaps someone else. That don't we all want that for ourselves, that at mm-hmm. some point, mm-hmm. if we want to talk to a pastor and a chaplain, mm-hmm. that's great. But maybe sometimes we want to talk to people who are closer to us and say the things that we need to say to each other, like mm-hmm. I love you. Mm-hmm. As a family member or as a close friend, we know that we can carry that with us in our soul after they're gone.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely, one of the best things I've ever done was, that I'm not even going to call it care. That mm-hmm. keeping that relationship with her mm-hmm. going on a daily basis. And, it was amazing because I think it probably helped her, but it sure as heck helped me understand what yeah. was going on,
And look at the beautiful memories you created. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Huh. Absolutely. Yeah. So,
priceless, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So totally, totally can relate to exactly what you're saying. And I think it is interesting. I mean, when you do look at it from the quotation mark caregiver end, there are some serious concerns. Obviously, we're having an older population living longer and potentially fewer caregivers with children, the family caregiver ratio, which, as you know, is the sort of number of family members who are available to take quotation mark care of somebody, which, not that long ago was, 6 or 7 family members per person, is estimated in a few years to go down to about 3 to 1 from 7 to 1.
Right.
And so that pool is limited, and the professional caregivers ratio also, and this is interesting stuff too, you think of a place that is sort of known for retirement and these later years, like Florida. You say, oh, God, they must have fantastic services. No, some of the worst professional caregiver ratio are in not surprisingly, are in towns that are well populated with people in their 80s and 90s. There just isn't the professional caregiving no. to go around. It just isn't. I mean, it's astronomical.
Yes. What I think that it's our responsibility to also take a look at some of the organizations that are in support of the professional caregivers and to do our homework to help them get better pay and to be insured and to do the things that employers need to be looking at. And I spent a lot of time talking about this in my second book, because I said we can prepare for our care if we need it as much as we can. But if you can't give your money away to someone who is not there, none of it will be any good. So I had urged people to take a look at the professional caregiver organizations that are out there that are in need of new policies and procedures. We can help them get what they deserve to do this hard work. So it's that's an advocacy that has to happen with our generation right now.
Absolutely. And this is relevant because I'm just working on a book with a woman who actually is from the Chicago area. And she was one of 8 siblings. Mm-hmm. 5 of them were developmentally disabled. 5 developmentally disabled kids out of 8. Some of that was to do, I think, with very poor obstetric practice that created mm-hmm. problems at birth. A lot of these kids were born in the 40s and early 50s. Mm-hmm. And so this is her story of being of the sort of normally developed SIBs. She's the one who's really had to take care of 5 others. And in researching the facilities, the services, how those have gone at all sorts of levels, it's a nightmarish story. It's a nightmarish story, from creating by closing institutions, which may not have been the ideal thing, but just send literally millions of people out onto the street and create homelessness.
Right.
Bad idea. To assume that, you know, the profit motive will keep these places in business doing the right thing.
No. So you can see the importance of these and other stories of us becoming advocates in right now. It's imperative. No one will take care of us if we don't start helping develop these businesses, including housing. We must get involved.
Yep. Yeah. And the sad thing about it, whether we're talking about the aging population or the disabled population, is unfortunately the workforce are not educated. They are not educated properly or trained properly in what they need to do. They're amongst the lowest paid, lowest trained workers, where really the reverse needs to be true.
Exactly.
And it's when you dive deep into it, it's a bad situation.
So let's get everybody involved, and hopefully we can change things.
So while we're on that, and it's so important, I don't want to lose it, what would you suggest then if people say, okay, well, how can I become part of advocacy for better care, whether we're talking about aged and disabled? What can somebody do? If a listener says, you know what, this makes perfect sense, I want to help.
Right. So I don't know the resources off the top of my head. They are listed in my second book. Right. And I even say, when I'm talking about the resources, we need to get involved in these specific things, and that they should call or go to the website. And very often there are action plans. They're always asking for money. I'm not necessarily thinking that money is the answer. I think it's going to be more about policy. So as long as we get involved and just contact our senators and our community leaders, there's so much, Howard, that can be done. Here's the thing. People always say, oh, I don't know what to do.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then I also hear, well, how am I supposed to do stuff if I can't get out of the house, or I don't drive anymore, and this and that? And I said, do you have a telephone? Do you have a mouth? Mm-hmm. You don't need to go anywhere. In this day and age with the internet, there mm-hmm. is so much work mm-hmm. that we can accomplish. And I'm talking far beyond donating money, because mm-hmm. so many people can't donate, and nor should they have to. Just get involved and you will find this huge opportunities. And like I said, there's many resources listed in the book that I say, this is what we need to be doing right now. And so there's several categories: housing, dementia, and the care of professional caregivers. Just those three alone, mm-hmm, have at mm-hmm. it.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah. And just to be clear, that which book is that? The title is
Who Will Take Care of Me When I'm Old? Because if we don't have anybody to take care of us, it's because we did not do the work that we need to do right now.
Absolutely. Yes, exactly right. And one of the things, I'd be interested in your take on this. One of the things that I see often mentioned, propagated by different groups, is, oh, you got to stay in your house as long as possible. Stay in home as long as possible. Honestly, I mean, there comes a point. I mean, I understand that, but there comes a point where that is destructive, right? Where yes. all that means is total isolation, which is like the worst thing you can do, right?
Absolutely. I'm so glad you brought this up. Aging in place only works up into a point. Now, it doesn't mean you can't have roommates, right? Supplement some of what is needed. However, people do not see the whole picture. And like you said, isolation is the number one reason to not think that that's the end all.
Yeah, so absolutely. Yeah. Again, you know, the theme here is well-being. How mm-hmm. do you maintain or even develop well-being, you know, through these later years in life? And we know what those are. We know what those lifestyle behaviors are. And one of them, for sure, well, one of it's cognitive stimulation, you know, and the other absolutely is social stimulation.
Yeah.
Isolation is the worst thing you can do. You could, you know, have a 93-year-old mom living in a spacious castle, but if she isn't interacting with anything, anybody, that's the worst thing.
Well, if and this is the thing, as caregivers, we may be the caregivers of people who have the attitude, I don't care. I really like it. And so I give those people all the space they need to live their isolated life. And I do not challenge that. However, they're showing me that they are quite comfortable. My mother taught me this. She said, I really like sitting here watching television and enjoying my peace and quiet because I deserve it. And I said, you're right, Mom. You're absolutely right. And so she felt comfortable with that. And she had everything she needed to be peaceful. Good. That unless we are like that, that we need to plan for some other possible social interaction. So everybody's different. Mm-hmm. And if we're the caregiver of someone who really likes to be alone, I say we have to respect that. I did in the beginning when my mom came to live with us, I did in the beginning question it, and then she set me straight.
Well, good. And that's good. And I'm glad that you said that, because this is exactly the sort of discussion that needs to be aired where, you know, I make the statement about isolation, which I think is true in generality, but mm-hmm. then you point out, but there are some people who are quite happy to live on their own and do very well and don't want to be bothered. And if they are really doing that, you know, and they're thriving, hey, great.
Yes.
Great. But you know, that's where the nuance and the subtlety needs to come in. And we're not just talking about principle just for the sake of it.
Correct. If your parent is, or the person you're caring for is not complaining about being lonely and alone, then fine. And then that's that. If they are, however, then we have an opportunity to get a conversation going. But it's not assumed, right? The thing I've learned in elder care is every single one of these people is absolutely different from the other. There are no boilerplate. Mm. They're just, every single thing that everybody wants and needs and does is pretty unique.
Yeah, and that's interesting. And there's a risk, I think, of children of someone older to not appreciate that, perhaps, and see mm-hmm. the world from a different lens and not see what their parent absolutely needs, right?
Correct, because they're busy telling them as opposed to sitting back and asking questions. Mm-hmm. And that's the biggest, not only is that ineffective, but it does something worse than that. What it does is it destroys the trust that must be established. The more we make demands on people, the less they trust us. You should do this. You should do that. You mm-hmm. should stop driving. You should eat your broccoli, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Instead of, Do you feel afraid sometimes when you drive? Does that scare you? Wow, have you thought about it?
Right.
But this is what bonds us. But if I said, Howard, you know, you really need, I don't think you should drive. Aren't you too old to drive? What? Mm-hmm. I mean, no. You won't talk to me ever again.
I try and run you down in my car.
You know what I mean? So. Yeah, go. I don't blame you.
Well, of course, what you're talking about there is fundamental to communication. Mm-hmm. And I'm just about to launch a course on communication and influence, one of the things that I'm really interested in. And of course, most people, when they're trying to influence somebody, don't know how to do that. They go about it completely the wrong way. You know,
I'm so glad you're doing this course, because everybody needs to come to this course.
Thank you. No, absolutely. Oh, don't you think you're too old? It's not really the way to get that point across. at all, you know? So, I mean, but that's just a general issue that when you are trying to influence somebody, most people don't really have a clue. Well, not only do they not have a clue about how to go about it, but the way they do go about it simply reduces the chance of them actually influencing anything.
Yes.
Yeah. And again, there's a danger of being just assuming that the person is incapable, or you know best, or you know, and that's not going to go very well.
Right. It wouldn't go well with any relationship we have. Even try telling a 5-year-old.
Right.
Same thing.
Yeah, no, really.
Mm-hmm. No one likes it at any age.
Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely. And I mean, we're going to have to do more than one show.
Oh, good.
Here, right? Because
I would love to.
So many things that I'm thinking of right now in terms of how people interpret what they see going on, and how they may misunderstand, misperceive, and plan inappropriately because of it. You know,
fear is usually the culprit here. So we know that when we're seeing somebody do something and it's not our expectation of what should be done, we just immediately, we can feel it in our bodies. We get scared, but it's our fear. And we project it, and then we make demands when none of that may be existing in the person that we are with in the moment. So there's a lot of work we have to do ourselves in this process that will make everything go so much better. So yes, I would love to dive deep into what are all these misconceptions and how not to do things. But we have, you know, but we back up and we really dive deep on, but this is the way I want to do it. I give many keynotes and workshops in the workplace, because this is where the caregivers hang out, the family members, right? So they're at work and they got mom and dad and spouses and everybody falling apart around them. So I'm right in the ditches with the people who are employed and also their caregivers. And we had got into a discussion about this communication process, and I'm known for getting the room to discuss it out loud together. I'm not lecturing. It's a really wonderful, lively conversation. And I noticed one woman in the corner was just like, I could see her body language, and she was very upset, and she finally couldn't take it anymore. And she stood up and she said, "This is not how I'm going to do this. I am telling my mother what to do. I don't have time. My mother is driving me crazy. This is not going to work for me." And I said, I get that. And in your situation must be, maybe this is what is needed. Mm-hmm. I said, however, there may be some compromising that compromising the relationship. But if you're willing to accept that responsibility of you telling your mother what to do all the time, then that is the compromise. So that, I just want you to know that's what you're doing. And she pretty much said, I am so stressed. I have no time. I must do it like this. And I hear that. These are decisions that we make based on, many times my experience has been, maybe we haven't really thought much about or know the how-to of getting the same result in a less destructive way. Mm-hmm. So there's so much to learn. And so for you to be having this program and this opportunity for people to learn this, I can't even stress how important it is.
Well, thank you. And I agree with that. And we know on this, since you brought this up, we know that quotation mark caregiving many people is incredibly stressful and is associated with increased risk of, you know, illness and all of that stuff. And again, I think we might have to be careful here and not assuming, therefore, that all caregiving means, you know, you're going to be stressed out to the max.
Exactly. Exactly. And this is especially, the communication is really important when a loved one that we're caring for, or maybe we don't love them so much, but the person has dementia. So now we have to add another layer of what that's like and the stress level and all that. However, there are so many things to learn from people who are experts in communicating with dementia and with people who have the symptoms of dementia. And I hope that in your program, you might have someone who is an expert in that, because so many caregivers are dealing with that. I can only take it so far, but I'm not a dementia expert. That is a hugely important topic for you to cover.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Again, we're down to the communication again. I mean, communication between, you know, fully functioning, whatever that means, people is difficult enough, you know, without dysfunction creeping in. And again, people have some misunderstanding about some of these things. Just an example that I like to use. People say, oh yeah, you know, I can't remember that person's name, you know, or I couldn't remember where we went on that, you know, vacation. I can't remember that, you know, must be getting demented. A lot of those, no. What I say to them, do you have something on your computer that cleans the computer, you know, files you don't use because it's using up space that you don't need? That's what nature is doing. Why do you have to remember where you went on vacation 23 years ago or the name of your, you know, biology teacher? It's irrelevant. You haven't thought about it for years, so don't freak out about it, right? So there's some process of aging that is natural, normal, and actually beneficial.
That's right.
Right? Now, some of it, you know, when you get beyond that, where people, memory gets maybe worse and into different types of dysfunction, that is, you know, that is certainly problematic. But don't just assume that just because somebody can't remember, you know, a fact they haven't thought about for 25 years is a sign of dementia. No, it's a sign that they haven't used it and didn't need it. Let's get rid of it.
I love it. Great example.
Right. So again, I think it's very easy, and I hear what you're saying, and you're absolutely 100% correct. It's very easy to go into these situations with preconceived notions, with a biased mindset, often, as you said, fueled by stress and fear and overload, frustration, whatever, you know, whatever else is going on in your life. It's very easy to do that and miss the important thing.
And the important, right? Yes. And the more educated we are about certain things, the less we will beat ourselves up when we're not doing things perfectly. And there is no such thing as perfectly in this. And also the caregiver guilt, the constant companion of ours, and I have it too, but to a much less degree, having done this for so many years, but it's there. How do we manage that? People say, I feel so guilty about this and I feel so guilty about that. And they are so hard on themselves. And until we dive, that's another dive deep topic, caregiver guilt. It also drives a lot of our behavior. If something happens to my mother on my watch, it's my fault, right? This is not, there's no truth to that at all. But I can't tell you how many times I hear it And it's something that requires another 45 minutes talking to Howard.
Yes. Well, I actually have some personal experience of that because a couple of years ago, it was my wife's birthday. And, you know, we had plans to go out to dinner, but we were over at my mother-in-law, who was not actually doing, she wasn't doing terribly well. She had a cold or something, so she was in bed, you know. So we said, okay, we're just going out for dinner, then we'll come back. We went out to dinner and came back to see her. She's doing okay. She's fallen off to sleep and what have you. And my wife says, I wonder whether I should stay tonight. Mm-hmm. And I said, she seems fine. She seems was with it and she's just fallen asleep and she's going to have someone, you know, with her and what have you. Okay. And it seemed fine. And unfortunately, at about 1:30 that morning, we got a phone call say that my mother-in-law just passed away. And, you know, I think my wife carries some guilt to this day that, oh, she should have stayed with her. Honestly, if she stayed with her, I don't think, you know, not like they would have some wonderful life-ending conversation. I think her mother would have died in the sleep and she wouldn't even have known she had passed. But there was guilt there.
Yes, yes. And the interesting thing is so many parents do die when their children are not around on purpose because they are always and forever our parents trying to protect us to the end. And it's very common that parents will not be with us when they pass, like my mom. And I'm sorry to hear that people feel guilty about things they have no control over, but this requires a lot of talking through it, mm-hmm. and understanding they did the best that they could at the time.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean, so people say, I shouldn't feel guilty after, you know, so many years, but you know, as a psychologist that we don't get rid of the guilt, we manage it.
Right. Yeah.
It's human nature. It means we loved so much.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's true. And I also think, I know of a few stories like this. A good friend from the Catholic Church here is a priest, and he tells this story that I don't think is the only time it happened to him, but somebody called him up and said, oh, my dad is, you know, he's struggling and, you know, could you go talk to him? And, you know, and he went and talked to him and had this conversation with him about his life and how wonderful it was and what have you. And 20 minutes later, the guy passed away. And it was almost like he was given permission. He said, okay, now I can go.
Yeah, yeah. There's all kinds of interesting guilt. Guilt takes many, many different kinds of forms. It's very interesting. And I, instead of avoiding it, I usually go toward it so that I can learn. There's important lessons here. And they're all just wonderful stories to talk. And especially when caregivers get together and they talk about their guilt, it's amazing. And when we do our workshops together, you can imagine how guilty employed caregivers feel because they're always at work or they're with their family and they're juggling everything. And we have a lot of fun talking about guilt. And then by the time we're done talking about it, everybody's pretty much laughing. So.
Well, that's good. You need to laugh at anything, right? I mean,
oh, yeah.
One of my favorite quotes is, yeah, humor is just a funny way of being serious, right? And I think
great.
It is. We absolutely will continue this conversation because I think it's so important. But for now, tell the audience a little bit about your engagement with this whole field and how they can reach you and et cetera, et cetera.
So I am engaged in a variety of ways besides being an author and people can purchase books. Is I am typically a consultant for the professions. So people like yourself, insurance, money, law, housing, people hire me to do consulting on how to bring their products forward in a way that will be more respectful of in the language and also to increase the exposure that they get for their intended audiences. So that's pretty much, that's part of it. And the other thing is I am hired by corporations to help employees. And those who have elder care programs, they have me actually come on site and I like a brown bag lunch during lunch hour. And we sit around and talk and help employed family caregivers prepare and juggle their lives while they are working. And now that so many companies are coming back on in the workplace, it's starting to get my date book is filling up, which is great. So I have a website. It is elderindustry.com. That leads people to, I can't tell you how many interviews, how many articles, blogs, a movement that started as a result of my books, and just a variety of ways that people can get help. And then, of course, my books are sold wherever books are sold. They are published by major publishers. And so they have done a wonderful job of distributing my book around the world.
Well, you know, that's awesome. And I want to thank you for the work that you've done. I love the story at the beginning about how you got into it. So that's great. There are, for those of you listening in the show notes, there are links to Madame Leverde's work and ways to contact her. But this won't be the last conversation we are going to have. I really do feel we've just scratched the surface today, and I'd really want you to come back at least one more time in the relatively near future so that we can explore a little, go deeper in some of these issues that really are critical. They're just so critical. And if you're fortunate enough to have parents and family members who are living long enough, these are issues you are going to have to deal with and deal with effectively. You can't avoid them.
It's been an honor to talk with you, Howard. I've really enjoyed this.
Me too. We'll do it again soon. In the meantime, I'm Dr. Howard Rankin. This is How Not to Think. We've been talking with Joy Leverde, and look out for our next interview, which should be coming up soon. Thank you and take care.